Ana Castillo has published over 18 books of poetry, fiction, nonfiction, translations, and she has also edited some of the most important books taught in Chicano literature classes, Chicano studies, feminist studies. She is certainly one of my literary heroes, especially after reading the Mixuala Letters and So Far From God. Her latest book is Black Dove, Mama, Mijo, and Me. Ana, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate your time.
Congratulations on this book. This is a memoir. Is this your most personal book ever?
Yes, it is. It's a combination of personal essays and memoir essays that I compiled, that I wrote over a period of 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Some of it is, one of the earliest essays, which is the leading essay called My Mother's Mexico, was written over 20 years ago and published originally in 1994, I would say a good third of the book is brand new and unpublished and takes place in more current times in my life.
It's interesting. I was reading an interview with you about this book on the Los Angeles Review of Books. The writer of that interview referred to it as a collection of essays, and I thought about that, a collection of essays. And I thought, yeah, I guess it is. But when you're reading it, it doesn't come off as a collection of essays. It comes off as a memoir, as a book. Yeah, there's chapters, but it really doesn't seem fragmented. It seems like it's a complete organic work.
Well, I think the essay part were essays that I deliberately wrote for a specific audience. Let's say there's a very short essay called Bowing Out, which I wrote about my son when he was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sweet and it's sort of lighthearted. It's, about him as an adolescent and one of those tender moments, mother and son moments, at home. And that was published in maybe Salon.com or, Glossy Magazine. And it has that tone. But when I felt it was time and I needed to address some of the harder issues in my life, I was cognizant of all of that. And so maybe that's where you get that sense of my really digging deep and being more of a memoirist than a personal essayist.
I think also what gives the book a form, because again, and I mean this as a compliment to the book, that the book, it seems like a book. I mean, it's so unified and so organic. And I think maybe the subtitle, Mama, Mijo, and Me, contributes to that organic form, because it really is in many ways about your mom, about your son, and about being a mother and being you.
For a long time, I thought I would do a book of personal essays with the title My Mother's Mexico.
Right.
I gave her, a lot of credit in terms of shaping the woman that I am. She's been gone from this life for over 2 decades now. So what ended up happening as time has gone on, saw myself more as mother in this life than as daughter. And my son is now a grown man and also a parent. And so I have a lot more to say from that perspective.
Right.
I think I've lived now at least as much as I did as a daughter. I appreciate your observation and your comment about it being pulled together, because it is, it's a difficult task when you have random pieces like that that were
right.
made, over not only over a period of time, but with different things in mind. It's also part of the editing process when you weave them together to try to tell a whole story. In my case, telling the whole story is not just my story. It's never been in my mind about just me, but about my gente, y Chicanos, Mexicanos, Latinos, who find themselves in this country intergenerationally. And that was part of the objective was, how do I tell my story within the context of the larger story?
The title, Black Dove, which really is a beautiful title. It's a beautiful cover, too. But can you tell our listeners where that came from and why it captures the book?
Well, as I said, with the original intent for so long in my mind was My Mother's Mexico. And it just felt like it said it all for me, My Mother's Mexico. you know, she's still, our parents, our grandparents, our ancestors still inhabit a place inside of us. You know, we talk about ancestral memory. This is a little more closer to home. This is the memory that I preserve of my mother. She had a very beautiful singing voice, as did my aunt, whom I talk about, my tia Flora, who I have in an essay called Las Cartoneras. As girls, they, you know, they sang together on the radio in Laredo with their brother, their older brother, who became a band leader. I always thought that this was one of the gifts that all mothers had, was to have a beautiful singing voice, and they could whistle. Now I have learned quite differently, as anyone that's heard me try to whistle and testify. And when I was leaving home as a young woman, I was, you know, my late teens, I heard my mother singing from behind the door, in the front door, Paloma Negra. Paloma Negra is a very popular mariachi ballad. And for those who are not familiar with it, it does say it's a lover, it's a, or it's someone. In this case, it was my mother telling the person who is gone, I don't know whether to pray for you or to curse you. Yeah. And that's my mother. I hear those words and from my mother. I'm just a girl trying to do something with my life at that time, wanting to go to college. I wasn't even going very far. I was going downtown to community college, but I wanted to be on my own. And my mother, being a very traditional, mostly indigenous woman who was raised by her grandparents, so in a very, very strict context, she also brought me up that way. She saw a young woman leaving home without the benefit of a good husband, probably on the road to perdition. So she didn't foresee a bright future for me. So Black Dove was me in a way. There's, we have the black sheep in English, but for me, I was a Paloma Negra. And then a good part of the book talks about myself as a mother with my son, whom I also have the brightest expectations for. And it's a story with a happy ending. He's doing very well today as we speak. I'm very happy about that, very pleased about that. He's also a wonderful father. But during his 20s, when we all go through times that we like not to think about if we survive them later on, he did go through a spiral. And this is something that I addressed in the book. And so he's my little Paloma Negra as well.
Right. And not only that, you're, you know, developed as an artist and a political feminist and a Chicana, you know, all these developing all along as you're raising your son as a single mother. And there's a certain point in your son's development that you talk about where you realize, you know, you raise this boy, but he's suddenly a guy.
he's a guy who at home has had all the buena educación that we say, and you know, has been taught manners, and he knows how to wear a tie. Taught him how to shave, how to ride a bike, taught him how to drive. I was so proud of myself as a single parent, feeling I could be doting mother and disciplinarian, mom and dad, educator. He had a very good education. He zipped right through college. We like to believe that going to college, especially high school, used to be, you know, good enough. But at least having a bachelor's degree will get you not only a good job, but saved in this world as a person of color. But when my young man would walk out of our apartment in Chicago and walk over to the train, the L train subway, with the cops that are waiting there to frisk kids, and during the illegal stop and search scene, he was becoming and transforming into a different person. And indeed, where does he learn to be a guy but from other guys on the street and around him? And this was a dual life that he was cultivating beyond my sight. He did get involved in graffiti and hip-hop culture. I don't blame his decisions later on as an adult. They weren't always wise on hip-hop culture. I looked into it quite a bit because of my experience with my son, and I am very supportive of them in much of it, in the way that it brings much of our youth together. But he was living in another generation and dealing with contextual things that were going on in Chicago. We hear about what goes on in Chicago all the time. I was born and raised there. My father was also born and raised there. My granddaughter has been born and is being brought up there there's wonderful things about that city that I'm very proud of. And there's also some things that are very harsh in which I look at in those essays.
Yeah, there was that one touching moment in your book when you see your son has a bruised face and he's trying to hide it, and you find out that he was beaten up by the cops.
He was in his late teens, and I'm not quite remembering if he was it was when he was a senior in high school or he had just started university. His college of choice was only like 5 train stops away from us, so he was taking that same train that he took when he went to high school. And as it turned out, one of those stop and search evenings, he had a, from what he shared with me, he had a half a smoke joint in his pocket. I don't advocate doing illegal drugs, but I also discuss a lot about drugs in our communities in the book. And he was afraid. And instead of figuring out, well, you know, what would be the penalty for that, he decided to make a run for it. And they,
yeah,
they caught up to him, and they, you don't do that. Nobody runs from the police.
Yeah, and it certainly reveals the struggle, not only of being a single mother, but of being a young man of color, you know, growing up in Chicago, or actually growing up anywhere. You even evoke the Taylor Marvin case.
Trayvon Martin has broken the hearts of many, many people in this country, but it's also a quintessential example of the stereotyping and the profiling that young people, young men of color in particular, but all people of color experience before 9/11. I talk about in the book myself being profiled as a young woman in Chicago and elsewhere. Trayvon Martin was an absolute victim of this society, and the injustice is gross and revealing of what we experience to live in every day. I'm not saying that my son or even I have always been perfect angels in public and whatever else we were doing, but there is this stigma that's visual and is unjust and that we have to address and recognize as a country.
At what point in the writing process or putting together this book, because I know it took, you say, 20 years, but once you began to know that this is a book and you began to work towards knowing what to keep and what not to keep, at what point did you begin to read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which you say is a very meaningful book for you in terms of how you put together the story of your son?
Well, I wrote essays, as I said, for a very long time. And the first book that I had in mind would have been a very different book. It would have been a compilation of probably many of the keynotes that I've written and given over the years and so on, maybe a little more academic. In this case, where I begin to turn to memoir has to do with I started to teach memoir workshops, memoir writing workshops in 2009, which I have given around this country to the general public and even in other countries. I believe very strongly that all of us have a story to tell. And those of us who have that itch to write, we don't always have to write it. You could tell it in many different ways. But if you have an itch to write, it doesn't matter if you're writing it in a journal or if you're just going to leave it for your grandchildren. The point is to document the story for the benefit of those to come. One of the things that I talk about in the workshops is that memoir isn't necessarily autobiographical in the sense that it isn't chronological. Where you decide to start writing a memoir is at the point in which you have something tearing at your heart that you need to figure out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's a conundrum. It's a great mystery. And whether or not you will ever figure out isn't even the objective. The point is the process, the journey of writing it. You heal, and you, or maybe you don't heal, but you come to some conclusion, some closure, some resolution in the process of writing it. So what happened with this book, I was sort of forced and compelled to finally put it together, was my own heartbreak when my son spiraled and ended up in the penal system after college, after playing cello in high school all those years, being the light of my life, after even becoming a head of household and a dad, I felt it was time to walk my talk and to begin the investigation, the reflection of how we as a family had gotten there.
One of the interesting details of the story of you and your son, it's a beautiful relationship, by the way, but one of the really beautiful details was at a certain point you decided, you know what, I'm going to take my son to, and here's the weird part, Galapagos Islands. Who does that? But you took him. You said, let's go. Where you took him to the Galapagos Islands, and he loved it, and it was a wonderful time. But how did that come about? Why did you decide, okay, I'm not going to take him to New York. I'm not going to take him to, you know, Paris. I'm going to take him to the Galapagos Islands.
Well, he had already been to New York many times. He is the son of a speaker and a migrant scholar. Part of how I was able to support my family as he was growing up by taking residencies around the country.
That's right, yeah.
So he did get to see Washington, D.C. because of my work and also other places. So where do you take a kid that's been to a lot of places? He went to Amsterdam when he was in college. Because of me, the idea of the Galapagos is, of course, has a lot to do with my own interest in the world and in life, and I really greatly wanted to see it before they start building those hotels they say they're going to go in and, of course, destroy one of the most precious and virginal places on this planet. And what better gift could I give to my newly college-graduated son? But on a trip like that. And this was the young man that I had raised and who had all of this, is what we would consider privilege. Being my only child, it was affordable for me. If I had more, perhaps it wouldn't have been. But he had all of that information. He had read Homer in his high school program. He was better educated than I was. I went to secretarial high school. So this is a person that is living this dual life in society, and we began to address that once again after he hit rock bottom and starting to build his life again was a lot of these ideas that we explore in our travels and looking at the world. We're not just looking at our family or looking at our immediate culture. We are very proud to be Latinos, and we are very cognizant of being brown and indigenous-looking people. But we also look for a place in how we connect with the rest of the world.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense, especially when you consider the Galapagos Islands is where Darwin made some of his initial observations that would ultimately lead to the origin of species.
We're being given a little talk by one of the tour guides about, there was a lot of amphibians there, obviously, but amphibian life. And he turned and he poked me in the stomach, my son, and said, I came from there, Mama. Like his little child, you know, he was about 22 years old. Like, it just hit him, you know, how all that happens. Yeah. So I thought that was a funny moment for me. But I also talk about, it was at the Galapagos in which the role, interestingly enough, the role changed for us when we decided to go scuba diving to a cove where there are some sharks.
Mm-hmm.
And sharks there, as far as anybody knows, have thus far never attacked anybody because they're in their natural environment and they eat well and they're not treacherous that way. They did scare me. I was afraid, but I figured I hadn't gone that far not to see that. And I found myself, not being a good swimmer, you know, being afraid to go out to that cove, my son, who is a good swimmer, taking my hand and leading me there.
Yeah.
And it felt at that moment that we had, like those other creatures in the Galapagos, now reversed our roles, and he was now becoming the protector of the family.
Wow, that's really beautiful. I remember a friend of mine who went to Israel when he was 7 years old with his family, and they had, I guess they were in an apartment there, and the parents sent him one morning to go to the store to get some bread, and they gave him some coins. And so he's walking down this street, this stone paved street, that's been there for thousands of years carrying coins in his hands. And he just kind of felt the presence of, if not ghosts, the presence of his past, of the generations. And that kind of sounds like the Galapagos Islands was in many ways a very spiritual experience, linking you not only to each other, but linking you to the entire species, as it were.
In that essay, Swimming with Sharks, I refer to an earlier time in my son's life in Chicago when the Latin Kings had
stolen his bicycle.
Yeah. And stolen his new race bike, and I was, you know, the protector, and I went and I got it back from them and so on. So it wasn't, you know, we had the analogy also of the contemporary life that we're living in, the, in an urban context, and then being at an environment like that. Another thing that I noticed that also connects us historically and traditionally and just universally is how much books taught me and spoke to me in my life. Of course, I was read to my son as a child, but how as adults, once he hits bottom and I began to try to salvage my son's mind and bring him back, I did it with what I knew best to do, and that was to connect with other books.
Right.
And we began to have that relationship as readers and writers.
I'm talking to Ana Castillo, whose brand new collection of essays, memoir, is just been released. It's called Black Dove, Mama, Mijo, and Me. Ana, you were talking about books, and your mother used to read a lot of books, and she would write down passages and keep them in notebooks. And then you also mentioned some of your the authors you used to read, the ones you loved, like Kafka, Toni Morrison, Kurt Vonnegut Jr., and even the Bible. You used to read the Bible. In fact, I love how you say that the Bible is magical realism because of all these really fantastic stories, which kind of reminds me of Borges saying that the Bible is great fantasy literature, and that's how he read it. But I'm wondering, you know, when I think of people like Kafka, who presented us with a situation with a different reality than Toni Morrison, where pretty much a jazz saxophonist can fall from the sky, and the Bible, where, you know, Moses can part the Red Sea, all these different ways of seeing reality. I'm wondering if they had an influence on the way that you're able to write reality that is nonlinear and non-material, or if they just reinforced the way you see reality.
I find that I have had to look for sources as a Chicana writer and as an early poet decades ago, during a time in which we did not have U.S. Latinas published that we could go to a bookstore, to a library, and find and be our guides, our guiding lights. I found that I had to put together other sources from literature that spoke to my identity. It wasn't my mother that was the reader.
Oh, it was your aunt.
Her mother.
No, oh, grandmother.
Her
okay.
mother. And her mother died when my mother was a child. And my mom kept her journal and preserved it, amazingly enough, and passed it on to me. And I think while I was starting to become a young writer, my parents, who were both, you know, worked in factories, they read the newspaper every day. That was the extent of the reading that they had time
right.
for. They would look at each other and wonder where I came from because of how much I was doing, reading and writing and painting and drawing, and just kind of just came into the world that way. So as a young Catholic girl, I looked for in resources and literary resources stories that would connect to the beliefs that I was given. I, as a Catholic, was told that Jesus died and physically rose again on the third day. That's what makes us Catholic, that we believe it was physical. So when I read the Old Testament, I think, like, wow, those were, like, really magical times.
Because right.
a lot of stuff was going on. Adam lived to 800 years old, you know, so
right.
they were my first sources for storytelling, and nobody was questioning whether or not it really happened.
Right.
Then I looked for, as a young woman and reader, in my late teens, I was looking for a little closer source to our history here in the U.S. and with people of color, and I discovered Toni Morrison and the Song of Solomon. And
yeah,
then I'm reading, someone told me about Anais Nin. She's a diarist, and she was Catholic. She had a Spanish background. And she was a woman amongst male artists, and I found myself as a young Latina aspiring poet and artist in Chicago surrounded by mostly men, mostly guys.
Mm-hmm.
And the Henry Millers of their day, if you will, where they wish they had been, had a very macho attitude. And so I needed someone I could identify with
right.
on that level. So that's what we do. Style is a combination of influences, and those were some of my early influences.
Yeah. We're running out of time. I'm talking to Ana Castillo, her new book, Black Dove. You write, no writer alive will ever concede to have finished a book. What did you leave out of this book that you wish you would have put in?
Today, I'm still sort of overwhelmed at how much I allowed myself to say.
Yeah.
I practice what I preach in my classes, which is you say what you have to say. You can always edit out later on. And just for the record, I didn't edit out anything really from there that was substantial for me. I'm finding it very liberating to speak my truth. And if there is anything in the months ahead or in times ahead that I feel that I want to correct in terms of myself or have reflected and rethought or realized that I left out, because memory is so tricky.
Yeah.
We remember things one way, and then people come along and remind us it was very different. I think I have the mettle now, the courage to sit down and write it, and hopefully this won't be the last memoir collection that I am able to deliver.
Well, it's a beautiful and incredibly brave book, and congratulations. I wish you the best on this one, and thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thanks so much.